Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of this conversation, and I'm pleased to have, to be speaking with Maria Cristina Garcia, author of The Refugee Challenge in Post-Cold War America, published by Oxford University Press in 2017. Dr. Garcia is the Howard A. Newman Professor of American Studies in the Department of History at Cornell University, where she also holds a joint appointment in the Latino Studies program. She has served as president of the Immigration and Ethnic History Society, and her books include Havana, USA, Cuban Exiles and Cuban Americans in South Florida, published by UC Press in 1997, and Seeking Refuge, Central American Migration to Mexico, the United States, and Canada, which was also published by UC Press in 2006. Hello, Maria Cristina, and welcome to New Books in History.
Hello. Thank you for your interest in my work, David James. I really appreciate it.
No problem. I'm thrilled to be discussing your wonderful book with you. Before we get there, I'm just hoping you could take a few moments and introduce yourself to our audience, maybe say a few things about your personal and professional background.
Sure. Happy to. I'm a historian of immigration, and I have a particular interest in refugee migrations from the Americas. My scholarly interest in immigration comes out of my own personal experience. I was born in Cuba, and my family immigrated to the United States in the 1960s. I guess I should say we were allowed to immigrate because many of my my family, like many of my compatriots, we arrived with visa waivers under a status known as humanitarian parole. It wasn't until many years later, when I was an undergraduate student at Georgetown University studying immigration history, that I realized just how privileged our experience had been. This is not to say that we didn't struggle. I think every immigrant and refugee who comes to the United States struggles in some way. But legal doors were open for us in ways that they were not opened for other immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers. So Our experience was privileged in that sense. When I went to graduate school at the University of Texas at Austin, my interest in immigration history solidified. At the time, this was the 1980s, Latino studies was still comparatively undeveloped. And I knew that I could best make a contribution to that field. I wanted to make a contribution to that field by writing about immigrants from Latin America and making their stories visible. So my first book, Havana, USA, came out of that impulse, came out of that desire, and out of that personal experience. It's a story, as the title implies, it's a history of Cuban migration to South Florida after the Castro Revolution. But as I was writing that book from the comfort of my apartment in Texas, a very different story was playing out along the U.S.-Mexico border. Hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans, Guatemalans, and Nicaraguans were fleeing the civil wars of the 1980s. But unlike the Cubans, they were finding that their entrance to the United States was blocked. And so as I was writing my first book, I knew at that moment that I wanted my second book to look at Central American migration and I wanted to make their stories visible. I wanted to make their stories and experiences known. And so that book became Seeking Refuge, and it examines how refugee policy becomes politicized and becomes a tool of U.S. foreign policy interests. And it uses that Central American case study as an example. And today I continue to research, write, and teach about immigration and refugee history and refugee issues.
Well, great. Well, thank you for that, and particularly for discussing some of your previous work, which has been so important in several fields. I'm wondering if we could kind of segue into talking about your book by approaching the fact that this is a very recent history, right? And in many ways, this is very much speaking to our contemporary moment. So if you will, would you discuss what does it mean for a historian to breach this topic that has been covered by social scientists and policymakers? And so essentially, I guess, maybe how does this look differently, and what does a historian's frame or lens have to add to these conversations?
Well, addressing this topic or writing about this topic as a historian has its challenges, as you know, because many of the sources that historians draw on aren't available. They haven't been declassified or they're otherwise made unavailable. Interviewees become difficult to identify and are unwilling to go on record. And so many of the sources that we rely on to flesh out that history is a challenge. And so writing about the recent period requires you to draw on the social scientific literature. But then it forces you to examine, well, what sources are available that I can draw on to tell this story? And you write the story however you can, with the understanding that others will then follow and build on it, right? So I know that this is not the definitive work on refugee and asylum policy in the post-Cold War era. It begins, hopefully, it has contributed to the conversation. And I know that other historians will follow me and build on that work and flesh it out and make it more real, make it more comprehensive, I should say.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And what I appreciated as I read it, and I shared with you a bit earlier, that we just read it as a class, and one of the classes I'm teaching, is that there's also a sense of, I think, the methodology of a historian also to, you know, be interpretive and to write as in a narrative fashion, I think also helps to bring coherence to what is a very complicated and multifaceted set of issues and policies. As you covered in your introduction, there's literally been thousands of articles, right, throughout the social sciences and books that have been written about this subject. So it really does help to have in relatively this early stage, a narrative and a framework and an interpretation to bring this together. I think particularly something that really situates itself well to teaching in a classroom.
Mm-hmm. And I think if you follow refugee issues, asylum issues, immigration issues, you notice that there's an ideological shift underway, right? I wanted this book to examine how policy has been shifting since the end of the Cold War. I'm particularly interested in policymakers and how they have responded to different humanitarian crises after the Cold War, how political, foreign policy, and humanitarian interests have shaped refugee policy. But I was also especially interested in looking at the role of advocacy, because it seems that now more than ever, advocacy is shaping the contours of immigration policy, refugee policy. I wanted to give particular attention to the individuals, the groups, the faith communities, the non-governmental organizations who have been advocating and pressuring for particular outcomes, and in many cases, successful. They're part of that story, right? It's not just a top-down history. It's also very much a bottom-up, looking at the various actors who craft policy in response to particular emergencies.
Thank you for bringing that up. And my next question will actually get to that a bit more directly, because I did notice that something you're very clear in framing this study kind of through those two approaches, right? That the policy side is this top-down view of it, right? The kind of debate between or the tensions between different branches of government, et cetera, policymakers. But then you also have the advocacy stemming from below. So I do want to get there. I just also wanted to clarify, at least for our listeners, if you could discuss the differences and the similarities between the statuses of refugee and asylum and asylum seeker.
Right. Well, a refugee has a very precise definition, right? We tend to use the word refugee quite freely. Journalists do, faith communities, in casual conversation, we use the term refugee, and there seems to be a general understanding of what that means, of what it means to be a refugee. But legally, a refugee is defined in a very precise way. And it's the 1980 Refugee Act that has offered our legal definition of who a refugee is. And the 1980 Refugee Act defines a refugee as a person outside of their country of origin or of habitual residence who has a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. A refugee has to be out, as I said, outside of their country of origin or of habitual residence. They have to be able to demonstrate that they could not find safety or security simply by moving to another part of his or her country. They have to demonstrate that there doesn't seem to be any reasonable chance of returning home in the immediate future. And they have to be able to demonstrate that they have not committed a crime, that they have not engaged in any kind of activity that would make them a threat to the security of their new country, say the United States. If they can do all of that, they might have a reasonable chance of securing refugee status. But today, less than 1% of refugees worldwide are ever resettled in a third country like the United States. It's very, very difficult to secure a refugee status. So a refugee is identified abroad for resettlement in a third country like the United States. An asylum seeker is a refugee, but what distinguishes an asylum seeker is the place where he or she requests protection. An asylum seeker requests protection at a port of entry, say the U.S.-Mexico or the U.S.-Canada border. They might ask for protection at a U.S. embassy or consulate. They might ask for protection on a U.S. Coast Guard vessel. It has to be U.S. territory. But the burden of proof is always much higher for an asylum seeker because there is this presumption that asylum seekers intend to deceive the bureaucracy, the refugee bureaucracy. So the burden of proof is always much higher for an asylum seeker, and it's much more difficult to secure asylum at a port of entry, or through the bureaucracy, I should say.
Right. No, and thank you for that. And there's that issue of where they're applying from, right? Is kind of a key distinguisher, right? And I guess I've heard the phrase that it's something in terms like that all refugees were at one point an asylum seeker, but it's not the same other way around, right? Because asylum seekers are trying to get the refugee status, but they're also applying in a different place, right? Usually, as you're mentioning, right, at that place of a port of entry, or they've already kind of made it to that destination country, and that's where they're applying, right?
Absolutely. And complicating it even further, at least today, asylum seekers either follow what is known as the affirmative channel or the defensive channel. There's separate tracks in the asylum bureaucracy. So let's say that an asylum seeker arrives on U.S. territory and has a period of time to go to the office, a USCIS office, United States Customs and Immigration Services. They can go to an asylum office and request asylum. And that is known as an affirmative claim for asylum. And that case is evaluated by asylum officers who are trained to evaluate those particular cases. Another way that you could request asylum is through the defensive track. Let's say that you enter the country, the United States, without authorization. You're here for a period of time and you are apprehended, say, at a routine traffic stop. And at that moment in time, you decide to request asylum. That sets you on the defensive track for asylum seeking. And your case is heard through a different channel, usually the immigration courts. And it's in the defensive track that it's particularly hard to secure a successful outcome. Because again, the perception is that the asylum seeker who has been apprehended and at that moment requests asylum is simply requesting asylum as a way to delay deportation. And so the burden of proof is even higher on the defensive track.
Right. And as you're explaining that, I mean, that's already at least conjuring in my mind, you know, the issue that that affirmative or defensive kind of position is really matters to the place of origin in many ways for this migrant, right? I mean, I'm automatically thinking of, you know, Central American migrants right now in the United States that are caught under those similar circumstances to where is it actually the case that, you know, Central American migrants are filing more defensive claims as opposed to affirmative claims?
That seems to be what's happening, or at least at this particular historical moment. I should say, you know, actually your readers, your listeners might be interested to know that asylum became a particular challenge beginning in the 1980s in response to the growing number of Central Americans and Haitians who were requesting asylum at a U.S. port of entry. You know, before the 1980s, we also had asylum seekers, but they were comparatively fewer. And those who received the most media attention seemed to be the high-profile defectors from the Soviet Union or from the Eastern Bloc, say, Romanian gymnasts or Russian ballerinas or, Czech tennis players, right? And so, you know, these high-profile defections tended to attract a great deal of attention, especially during the Cold War. But beginning in the 1980s, the number of asylum seekers skyrocketed in large part because of the number of people who were fleeing Haiti in response to the despotic Duvalier regime, but also because of the civil wars in Central America. So we saw a growing number of people crossing over land, going to Mexico, Canada, the United States in search of refuge. And so since the 1980s, we've had more and more asylum seekers every single year. And that has led to the perception that not everyone who's coming from Central America has a bona fide claim, that they're simply economic migrants in search of protection or in search of opportunity. But the migration from Central America is and always has been multi-causal. It's economic, it's political, it's climate-driven, it's a number of factors have driven people to leave the region to come to the United States.
Indeed. You know, and those two case studies that you just mentioned with Haiti and Central Americans in particularly, right, they pose a sharp contrast to your family's own personal experience, right, and that of Cuban refugees, particularly during not only just the early Cold War period, but even into the 70s and 80s as these policies were shifting, and it was becoming more aware, at least to the American public, that there was a concern over the numbers of refugees that were coming, as well as this is also intersecting with concerns over undocumented migration at that time. So in order for me to frame this into a question, is what I think this does well can help us perhaps discuss is the kind of tension between or confusion between the branches of government that are responsible for asylum and refugee policy. And can you explain that a bit? I think that's where you use these examples, and I think that's in your first chapter of essentially the debate and the tension that goes on, particularly between Congress and the White House. In the early post-Cold War years.
Mm-hmm. Well, Well, before I talk about the post-Cold War years, I think it would be important to explain what's happening during the Cold War, because as I mentioned earlier, there is an ideological shift, and that ideological shift is shaping how refugee policy is playing out. So during the Cold War, anti-communism was the lens through which policymakers interpreted who was worthy of admission to the United States as a refugee or as an asylum seeker. And not surprisingly, the vast majority of people who were admitted as refugees came from the Soviet Union, Vietnam, Cuba, and other communist countries. Coming from a communist country didn't guarantee that you would be admitted to the United States, but it did maximize your chances because those who made decisions on the ground regarding admission operated on the premise that communist countries were inherently oppressive. Even after Congress passed the 1980 Refugee Act, which adopted the United Nations definition of refugee and tried to strip policy of its ideological bias, the United States continued to prioritize those fleeing from communist countries. After the Cold War, though, it seemed that refugee policy was moving in a more expansive direction. We began to admit, you know, once we moved away from that communist ideological bias or anti-communist ideological bias, we tended to move in a more expansive direction. We began admitting people who would never have been considered during the Cold War. We started admitting people who were fleeing gender and sex-based discrimination, for example. We started admitting victims of trafficking, people who were fleeing criminal violence. Again, they had to prove a well-founded fear of persecution. It wasn't easy to secure protection, but they were we were admitting more people from many more different many more countries under for many more reasons. And also our refugee quota was increasing, doubling and tripling in size. That change, though, began to change after 9/11. After 9/11, anti-terrorism became the new lens through which we interpreted who was worthy of admission to the United States. There, since 9/11, there has been this growing fear of sponsoring people from countries that are believed to be incubators of terrorism. And we've seen that the quota, the refugee quota, has begun to decrease, and the obstacles to receive refugee status or asylum have become even more considerable. Right. So, in sum, you know, for a brief period after 1989, after the end of the Cold War, we see this expansion in the way that we define refugee, and the people who are being considered, and our refugee quota is expanding. But then after 9/11, it begins to contract again because of this fear of sponsoring people from terrorist incubating countries.
Right. And because of that increasing fear, again, how does that actually, you know, create a type of tension or uncertainty? I guess my question is in regards to which branch of government, you know, should be handling refugee and asylum policy, because both have, you know, have made efforts, you know, to put their imprint on it, right? But the Constitution isn't quite so clear, right? As to it's not like Article 2 says, right, that it's the purview of the executive branch, right, to handle refugee policy, right? It doesn't work quite like that. So can you get into that tension that we've seen rise between Congress and the executive branch?
Right. Well, one of the reasons why Congress passed the 1980 Refugee Act is that they wanted to have greater control over refugee policy. Before 1980, many people were being admitted as humanitarian parolees, another way of defining refugees, and this was based on executive authority. Because of the 1952 Immigration Act, the executive branch had the authority to allow people into the United States outside of immigration quota if it was deemed in the national interest. by 1980, Congress had had enough of this because hundreds of thousands of people were being admitted for reasons that didn't seem all that clear to members of Congress. And so the 1980 Refugee Act was this attempt to exert greater control over refugee admissions. And so since 1980, since the Refugee Act, every year, the White House, the executive branch, in consultation with Congress, decides how many refugees will be admitted each year, each fiscal year. And they assign kind of percentages of that quota to different regions of the world, depending on the areas that they feel are especially vulnerable, where they want to admit the regions of the world that they want to target for refugee admissions. So there is this working together between the executive branch and Congress in terms of refugee policy, or at least there has been until fairly recently. In issues of asylum, as I mentioned, there are these two tracks within the asylum bureaucracy, the affirmative and the defensive track. If you're on the defensive track, that's really where the judiciary enters in, because it's the administrative courts that are making determinations about who will be admitted as an asylee into the United States. And that system is quite precarious for the person who is an asylum seeker, because what we know now from studying the asylum bureaucracy as it has evolved in the post-Cold War period, we know now just how difficult it is to receive asylum. We know that if you have legal representation, for example, your chances of receiving asylum increase dramatically, as much as 50 to 80%, your chances improve. But the vast majority of asylum seekers today do not have legal representation, because unlike in criminal courts, where you are guaranteed some type of legal representation, in the immigration courts, we are not required to provide legal representation, or even translators for that matter. So most asylum seekers navigate the asylum bureaucracy on their own. If they have legal representation, it's because it's been offered to them by on a pro bono basis by a law firm, or has been offered to them because thanks to the efforts of a non-governmental organization that has provided them with some type of translation service or legal representation. But the vast majority of asylum seekers do not have access to legal representation. We also know that your chances of receiving asylum vary on where you file your claim. You can have two identical cases, the circumstances of each case almost identical, and have each case heard in different courts across the country and have completely different outcomes. So decisions are not standardized necessarily, except in a few examples, which makes having legal representation all the more important.
And on that point, with the the asylum bureaucracy that's particularly run through the court system, is this because, I know it's not one thing, but it's part of the reason this is because of this effort to define these persecuted social groups, and that's actually not clearly defined in legislation, or, aside from like the 1948, right, UN Declaration on Refugees, right, and Genocide, and the 1980 Refugee Act. I mean, outside of those things, is it because there's not a really clear definition or test as to what constitutes a member of this group, and thereby it's left to just play this out in the courts on a kind of case-by-case basis to determine, in this scenario, does this person qualify because they're able to associate with this group or not?
Right. You're absolutely correct. The courts have been fleshing out what it means to be a member of a particular social group, for example. It becomes easier for a court to understand persecution on account of race, religion, nationality. But when you get to membership in a particular social group, that's when it gets tricky, And so there have been a series of court decisions over the years that have tried to define what it means to be a member of a particular social group. And it involves visibility, for example. And so it's those court cases that have helped to standardize our understanding of what it means to be persecuted, right? But what makes it especially tricky for the courts in trying to understand the or make sense of the legitimacy of a particular claim is that that reasons for migration are always multi-causal, as I mentioned earlier. I mean, we have this tendency in the United States to want to divide people into discrete categories. We say this person is a political refugee, this person is an economic migrant, this one is a climate refugee. But it's never that discrete. It's never that easy. Migration is always multi-causal, and trying to assess the legitimacy of a person's claim for asylum is always very, very difficult. And that's why legal representation, having someone there to advocate for you, to help you find the words through which to articulate your experience, becomes all the more important. And now it's because of the backlog in the system, in some areas of the country, the backlog, the wait to have your case even heard in a court can be as long as 3 years. I mean, the anxiety, the stress is overwhelming for the individual asylum seeker, especially since 9/11, we tend to hold people in detention if they cannot prove their identity, if they don't have family in the United States or friends who can vouch for them, who can attest to their safety, right? Who can provide for their safety and for their maintenance. We tend to detain and err on the side of caution, so to speak. It's inhumane. Of course, you can imagine holding somebody indefinitely while they await their asylum case, especially at this particular moment, is inhumane. And we have to, as a society, examine and explore more humane ways of allowing asylum seekers to remain in the country while they await their time in court.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, definitely. And we were on, since we're on the subject of this backlog, can you explain that a bit more? Why is there such a deep backlog? And I know it's not necessarily just an issue with this current administration. It's been an issue for decades of this backlog has just grown and grown and grown.
Yes.
Why is that?
Yes. The growing number of asylum seekers, that's part. We also don't have the bureaucracy to handle them. We have immigration judges, and there's enormous pressure on them to hear asylum cases. And in some courts, the pressure is to hear 50 to 100 cases per day. As you can imagine, in just one day, you can't really make a determination, an accurate determination, when you're under so much pressure to hear so many cases in a given day in order to address the backlog. There's just no way that you can give anybody a truly fair hearing, it seems to me. I know there are many who would disagree with me, but it seems to me that if you're working under that amount of pressure, there's just no way that you can give somebody a truly fair hearing, right? And so it's all of those factors, right? I find it puzzling that Americans don't want big government, right? They don't want big bureaucracy. But in order to have a fair and humane asylum system, you have to have a large bureaucracy. You have to have the judges. You have to have the legal counsel that allow people to make a claim for asylum and have that claim evaluated. And so reconciling those two tensions has always been difficult, and even more so now.
Thank you for explaining that. It's definitely something that my students and I, as we were speaking of your book, there was something that just baffled their minds, and they're really trying to struggle to understand what that is like, and what are these myriad causes to create, as you mentioned, like a 3-year backlog, and then, I mean, that's the backlog itself, but then also the series of legislation that is, in passed in recent decades that has led to, as what you mentioned earlier, essentially what is, indefinite detention for people that are seeking protection, but that, have been, convicted of no crime, have done nothing wrong, and can spend up to, at the minimum months, if not years, right, in a detention facility. Which, as we know, are increasingly becoming, privately run, which has its own issues and problems on that side. But that issue, can you speak of, so what types of legislation has created that shift to where not just the backlog, but to where we're detaining these people, literally putting them in jail more and more?
I began to see that shift, and many others have noticed this shift too, after the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. So before 9/11, there was this other major terrorist attack in 1993, and concerns about the role immigration played in facilitating that terrorist attack led to passage of the 1996 Illegal Immigration and Immigrant Responsibility Act, IRA-IRA, right? And IRA-IRA, this 1996 law, this mammoth piece of legislation, covered all kinds of immigration-related issues. But within that law, there was also a discussion of asylum and a discussion of deterrence methods that should be followed in order to discourage people from coming to the United States without authorization and discouraging them from filing a frivolous asylum claim, right? So since 1996, it's become increasingly difficult to request asylum. And so we begin to see an uptick in the number of detention, detainees, immigrant detainees after 1996. We begin to see an increase in border enforcement and the increased use of technologies, different technologies in border enforcement since 1996. These kind of police operations and increasing militarization along the borders since 1996. And as you mentioned earlier, we also begin to see an increasing privatization of immigration detention after 1996. So up until the Trump administration, we began to see that individuals who are coming into the United States and apprehended, who can't prove their identity, who don't have family or friends in the United States who are willing to vouch for them, are detained while they wait their hearing in an asylum court or in an immigration court. But since the Trump administration, as you know, even those who can prove their identity, even those who do have family in the United States, are also increasingly detained. And this administration in particular has adopted other deterrence mechanisms, including the sending back to Mexico strategy to discourage people from coming to the United States, so forcing them to return to Mexico to wait for their asylum hearing over there. The separation of children from families, the separation of families in general, that too has become another form of deterrence. And so it's become increasingly draconian since 2017.
Yes, thank you for that. Quite a bit of what we've already talked about has connected to, I think, one of the key themes that you pull out, you know, in the beginning that influences post-Cold War refugee policy, which is that aspect of fear of both, you know, on behalf of policymakers and their constituents over economic, political, cultural developments, right? And trying to, you know, make judgments increasingly as, you know, in the era of the 1990s forward of concerns over terrorism. So its effect on all those different things. So I think we've covered a bit of that. Again, another wonderful part of this book is the consistent theme that you explain of advocacy and the role of the humanitarian community broadly, right, and the influence they've been able to have, right? Because from the top down, we've been talking about, which can seem to some of us, right, very kind of a, you know, oppressive and depressing system, right, that has continued to limit and constrain, it appears, right, the movement of people and the ability of people that are seeking refuge and asylum, which is quite shocking, right? I think in the post World War II era, where, you know, those chants of never again were we going to allow, right, something like the Holocaust to happen, and yet, you know, we see that happening. That's happened throughout the 1990s in several periods, and you discuss those case studies. So there's a lot of those fears and concerns, but can you speak more to this issue of the importance of, again, the humanitarian communities and how they've been able to provide that ground up swell, right, on behalf of people seeking these protections?
Oh, well, thank you for that question. Yes, humanitarian aid workers, human rights activists, journalists, clergy, scholars, lawyers, judges, all of these individuals, faith communities have played a role in advocacy during the Cold War and most certainly after the Cold War. And it's individuals of conscience who remind us, they continually remind us of the values that we claim to believe in, right, as a society. The United States claims to be founded on particular principles, and we claim to believe in particular values. But oftentimes we lose sight of those values. And it's these individuals and groups and faith communities and lawyers and judges and journalists who continually force us to recommit ourselves to those values. They are the ones who remind us of who we are or who we claim to be as a nation. And so through their advocacy, through their writings, through their op-eds, they continually remind us of who we are as a people or who we claim to be. And we see that they often have an impact in the shaping of policy. They hope through their activities, through their writings, they help to pry open the door to the United States, right? They force administrations from the Reagan administration on. You begin to see how these individuals and communities are shaping the discussion about who or what a refugee is, who or what an asylum seeker is. And they're putting pressure subtly and sometimes quite forcefully on politicians, on the people who craft policy, on the people who interpret policy on the ground. They're putting pressure on them. They're advocating. And they're encouraging an opening of the door to accommodate particular groups that they feel that we have forgotten. So an example from the recent past, for example, has to do with the Iraqi and Afghan translators, right? When we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, when we increased our military presence in that region of the world, we depended on so many translators and other support personnel from that country to follow that mission, rightly or wrongly. But then later on, we lost sight of them, right? And it was Americans of conscience who reminded policy makers that we had an obligation to assist those people who had put their lives on the line and help them to find some type of accommodation here in the United States, because they were in danger. Their lives were in danger. Their families were in danger. And so through special immigrant visas, through refugee status, through different other types of legal accommodations, as I spell out in Chapter 3, we were able to offer admission, admittance to Iraqi and Afghan translators and other support personnel to come to the United States. And again, that wouldn't have happened otherwise, I don't think, without people of conscience stepping up and saying, well, wait a minute, we have an obligation here. You know, we're forgetting that we have an obligation here, and we have to work to allow people to come in.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, I think most of the examples that you discuss in regards to individuals or groups, right, making successful claims and having a positive outcome in this process of seeking refugee protections or even asylum, that they had some type of advocacy group or on working on their behalf, right? And that is actually vital. I mean, as in kind of like that asylum process, that those peoples that don't kind of have that type of advocacy are the ones that are not going to get connected, right, with an attorney, that are not going to get representation through this vast bureaucracy, which is so critical, as you've already discussed, right, to having any chance of having a positive outcome.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
I'm also wondering, I know our time's running short, so I'm going to try to pull these, I guess it's one to two questions together, but I guess the bigger question is, do you kind of see this era that you write about as representing a type of dilemma, for liberal democracies in the post-Cold War era? That is, again, I'm referring back to, the 1948 Convention on Genocide, and, that's still that memory, everyone's still taught, at least in the United States, I think in several other Western liberal democracies, about, the Holocaust. And yet we see so often how, throughout the case studies that you discuss, how that's failed. At least it's nation states themselves, due to their internal politics, have failed to step in, right, and prevent genocide, like the cases in Bosnia or Rwanda or Kosovo, which you discuss, right, or even the Iraq War, right, the aftermath of the first Gulf War, right, the place of the Kurds, right, and so it just I'm just wondering does this say something deeper, kind of about a failure of these liberal nation states to kind of uphold these humanitarian values?
Yes, you could see it as a failure. I think part of the problem is that we have been responding on an ad hoc basis, right? Instead of working together regionally. I think after the Cold War, there was a greater realization that that refugees and displaced persons were increasing in size, that this was going to continue to be a challenge of the future, and that in order to address this challenge, we needed to work together to share the burden, to recognize that we have an international responsibility, that we couldn't go it alone, individually, nation by nation, on an ad hoc basis, that we needed to work together as regions, as members of an international community, to address particular humanitarian crises, right? Unfortunately, while we do see examples of that burden sharing, and we do see examples of countries in particular regions coming together to address particular crises, humanitarian crises that have emerged, it hasn't been as developed or as one would hope, right? And moving forward, because this is going to be continue to be a challenge in the future, there needs to be a greater recognition, that we need to work together to address address humanitarian crises, the crises of the future. So yes, it is a failure. I'm particularly concerned that at this particular moment, the impulse is to militarize borders, to strengthen them, to make it even more difficult for people to find refuge in another country, and it's really it's quite scary. I don't know ultimately what's going to happen. I'm hoping that this is a temporary development, and that in the future that we will come together and address this challenge, because we have more refugees and displaced persons than ever before. And right now, as I mentioned earlier, less than 1% of refugees are ever resettled in the top 10 resettlement nations, of which the United States is one. The vast majority of refugees worldwide are usually in neighboring countries, countries that border areas of crisis. And refugee camps are growing in size. There are some refugee camps that are larger in size than U.S. cities. And that situation is untenable, right? It can't exist forever. We have refugee camps where we have multiple generations of families that have lived and have grown up in these refugee camps, and they don't have a nation, a country to call their own, right? And they have limited opportunities for education, for earning a livelihood, for medical care. And they live in refugee camps that are operated by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugee and other non-governmental organizations. And they live in these camps that, thanks to the generosity of countries that border areas of crisis, they have allowed those camps to operate and to exist. But at any time, the UNHCR knows that at any moment, those countries may tire of those camps and want them shut down and expel the people, the hundreds of thousands of people who live in those camps. And where will they go? And so these challenges, you know, the number of refugees and displaced persons will continue to grow in the years to come. And so now more than ever, there needs to be a greater cooperation, you know, within the international community to try to address the conditions that create displaced persons in the first place. But then once people become displaced, to address their needs and provide them with the protection that they need in order to survive.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think, you know, that's such a, you know, it key point, you know, that the need to come together. And it makes me think of, I think, currently what we're experiencing as not only a nation, but, you know, a global community with the current COVID-19, you know, pandemic. It's something I've been thinking a lot about and hoping. I mean, again, we've seen the ills of nationalism, right, and how that type of isolationist thinking actually is very, very harmful, to say the least, right, in the response to the rise of the coronavirus and COVID-19. And I guess my point is, what I'm hoping is that this will help us all to understand just how much really interconnected we are, right? And that these problems are global problems. And that's what I try to share with my students, that, you know, migration is not a national thing. This is not, you know, our own narrative of American exceptionalism makes us think that, you know, this is the country, the first choice country that migrants and refugees are always it's at the top of their list. But, you know, these are issues, as you mentioned here, the growth of the refugee population and their claims to Western countries. I mean, particularly, this is a movement right from the global south to the global north, right? And so this is a global problem that needs to be addressed, you know, as a global community, as I'm drawing this parallel to, I think, hopefully we're seeing now, right, that this issue of pandemics, we can no longer view that's what's happening on the one side of the world as not affecting us. It's going to affect us, right? And it already is. I guess that's one of my hopes, that I think this moment can help us all to understand, and that this applies to things just like these movements of refugees and that are caught in these just terrible circumstances.
Absolutely. And now, certainly as we're facing accelerated climate change, migration, both internal and across international borders, will become increasingly larger, right? I mean, the forecasts for the next 50 years are incredibly sobering. And so we have to come together as an international community to mitigate the effects of climate change, but then also to help populations become resilient or to adapt to the effects of climate change so that they don't have to migrate internally or across international borders. And that's a response that can't be national. It has to be an international response. We all have to come together. So unfortunately, at this moment in time, countries are isolating, they're militarizing, they're strengthening their borders. And yet that's the exact opposite of what we need to do. We need to be engaging. We need to be coming together to address these challenges that we all face, right? It's not just one country. We're all facing these existential crises. You mentioned COVID-19, but it is most certainly climate change. We have to come together.
Certainly. Thank you so much for bringing that up. I think that's a great place to, I think, wrap up talking about your book. But I did want to give you an opportunity before we end to perhaps share on what you're currently working on. This book itself was published in 2017. Do you have other, I know you have several projects going on, but would you like to share anything or make us aware of things that you have working, that you're working on now?
Thanks for asking. Yes, I'm actually just finishing a book on climate-driven migration. It's my new book. One of the things that I'm looking particularly at the Americas. I'm looking at climate-driven migration from the Americas during this period of accelerated climate change. I mean, one of the things that I noticed when I was writing The Refugee Challenge is that many of the refugees and the asylum seekers that I was looking at, that I was studying, were initially displaced by an extreme weather event of some sort or some type of environmental degradation. That environmental disruption forced them to move internally first within their own countries, but then eventually they were forced to cross international borders for other reasons, right? But by the time they reached the United States, they were categorized as either political refugees or environment or economic migrants. But the original source of their displacement was environmental, but it got lost in the whole conversation of political versus economic, right? And so that realization has led me to this new project. I'm examining the environmental origins of migration, right? The climate change driven factors that are forcing people to migrate. Now, having said that, one of the challenges in looking at climate-driven migration is that it's, as I mentioned earlier, migration is always multi-causal. It's at once political, economic, and now increasingly environmental. It's hard to tease out one primary factor for migration. What we do know at this moment for people who are displaced for environmental reasons is that they don't have any type of legal protections worldwide. Now, when you look at our definition of refugee, for example, right now, as I mentioned, you have to prove a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. Nowhere in that definition do you see climate or the environment. Right, so it's impossible to receive protection from the United States as a refugee for environmental reasons. Right, so if you are coming from Central America, for example, today, a region of the world which is hit hard by hurricanes on two coasts, by drought, by volcanic eruptions, by earthquake. And if you are forced to move internally before you move across borders to another country, there's no way that you can receive refugee protection for environmental reasons. You have to demonstrate that you were politically persecuted in some way, right? Or else you will not gain any kind of protection from the United States. Right now, here in the U.S., the only status that we have to address environmental migration is a status known as temporary protected status. We have since the 1990 Immigration Act, we have on the books this status called TPS, which allows the executive branch to offer temporary protection to a group of people if they can't return home for because of a political or an environmental disruption. But the catch is that you have to already be in the United States in order to receive that protection. You have to already be here as a student, as a worker, as a tourist. And if while you're here, an environmental disruption occurs in your country and you can't return home, then you might be eligible for TPS status. But as the name of that status implies, it's temporary, right? It's only for a period of time. And then you, the State Department evaluates when it's safe for you to return home. So we don't have anything on the books here in the United States or anywhere else around the world, for that matter, any type of protection specifically for people who have been displaced for environmental reasons. I know that in New Zealand, there has been conversation about creating a special visa for climate refugees, about 100 people per year. They're the first nation to really even engage in this kind of conversation. I know that the countries that are members of the African Union have long recognized that the environment can be a source of displacement that should be taken into account for refugee protection. But there needs to be greater guidance from the United Nations. And there needs to be a greater understanding that this is a challenge of the future and something that the nations, the international community, will have to address in order to offer protection to people who lose their homes and are in search of refuge.
Yes, thank you for discussing that. It makes me think of, it was actually another question I was going to ask but failed to, what is essentially, the kind of inadequacy of our current definition of refugees and whether that should be redefined. I mean, it seems like not only should that be redefined to, include, not only an additional category for environmental conditions and environmental, refugees, particularly suffering from climate change, but also a definition that understands the multi-causal nature, as you've been bringing up over and over again, right? Mm-hmm. That's where we're not forced to, identify a refugee with one category, that's kind of makes it all or nothing game for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And yet, I know that there is some resistance on the part of the United Nations to make the definition too expansive, because the fear of officials at the UN is, or the UNHCR, is that if you broaden the definition too much, that it will weaken the protections for those individuals who are fleeing, politically based persecution, for example, right? That the term will be so expansive that it will be rendered meaningless, right? Instead, what the UN has tried to do is to offer guidelines to nations on the rights of migrants and the responsibilities of nations in climate disruptions, right? But they're just that, they're guidelines. There isn't any obligation. It just basically tells nations what they should do, what they should take into account. And so there are many in the humanitarian and the human rights community who are hoping that the UNHCR will provide more concrete, a convention of some sort that specifically addresses the responsibilities of nations to climate-driven migration, because it is increasingly a challenge, will become even more so in the future. Even here in the United States, we already have our own climate refugees, people who have been forced to move and will have to be relocated because of various environmental conditions.
Right, certainly. Well, Maria Cristina, thank you so much for coming on to New Books in History and taking the time to discuss your wonderful scholarship. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David James. I appreciate your interest in my work, and thank you for spending time with me.